Snyder, George Strong, et al., Robert T. Francis, Appellate Counsel, Matthew W. Lee, Appellate Counsel.
You may proceed.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I am Ernest Francis, representing the appellant, Moonlight Enterprises, LLC. I would like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal.
All right.
We are requesting that this court vacate the decision of the Circuit Court for Fairfax County sustaining the pleas and bar on grounds of race judicata and statute of limitations. And we have alleged or set forth four errors, assignments of error. The first assignment of error presents the issue of when the statute of limitations began to accrue on the malpractice claims. And we would submit that the statute of limitations did not accrue until the judgment was entered in the Arlington County action. This case that's now before the court concerns alleged malpractice in an action that was filed in Arlington County. The case itself was filed in Fairfax County. And the judgment in the Arlington County action, in which we've alleged that the malpractice occurred, was on February 10th, 2012. We filed the case on February 10th, 2015. We were within the 3-year statute of limitations. And we submit, and it's our argument, that the representation of my client by the defendants continued up until the entry of judgment in the Arlington County action. The defendant's position, if it's adopted, would start the statute of limitations running before we could even bring a claim for malpractice. And that is generally a strongly disfavored holding. The claim for malpractice in this instance would not begin under the Van Dam versus Gay case until there had been a final judgment entered in the Arlington County action. But what the appellees are saying is that the statute of limitations began to run even before we could have sued them, even before we had a mature claim for malpractice. So, again, it's our position that the statute of limitations did not run until there was a final judgment in the Arlington County action. The second assignment of error assumes that the appellees are correct in their argument that they terminated their representation under the continuous representation rule as of the date that they finished performing services. Well, even if that's true, there are services reflected in the record in the form of an email from February 10th, 2012, in which they were advising my client, as to the status of the entry of the final order. That is a critical determination or a critical piece of information because it's what the entry of the final order is what triggers the running of the period for filing the appeal. You have 30 days, and that's jurisdictional. If you miss that 30-day period, you are out of luck, or the appellant is out of luck. So that's absolutely critical. That is something that should come from an attorney, as it did, and we would submit that those are continuing services and that the even if the appellees are correct, as I indicated earlier, their services did not end on the date that they said they were going to end. They ended on the date when the last services were actually performed.
How do you handle the argument that may be true for Zachary but not for Rose?
The appellees stated in their submission in the circuit court that if the statute of limitations, the statute of limitations ran as to both when it ran as to one. So it was their position that if it hadn't run as to one of them, it hadn't run as to either of them. That was what they represented to the circuit court in the proceeding below, and we would contend they're bound by that in this court. And they have not raised that as an issue or as an argument in their brief. The third assignment of error is that of res judicata, and we would submit that res judicata, and again, this is only as to the defendant Moreau's, we would submit that there is no res judicata issue in this case because there are different contracts, there are different retainers, different representations by the defendants of my client. There was a representation that concluded in 2008 relating to the purchase of certain condominium units. That representation concluded in 2008. And then we had a separate representation beginning in 2010, which dealt with litigation of certain disputed issues between my client and the board of the Homeowners Association. Again, those are two different contracts. And if you have different contracts, those need to be treated as separate causes of action for the purposes of res judicata. So, again, that's we would submit that because there are separate contracts, there are separate causes of action, and therefore res judicata does not apply.
May I interrupt you for a moment?
Yes, ma'am.
Why wouldn't the more refined response be res judicata applies to the allegations of malpractice attributed to the 2008 purchase transaction, and that's different from the allegations of litigation malpractice? That is, litigators screwed the case up for any number of reasons. You say there's five counts on that point. Why wouldn't that be the proper way to segment res judicata here?
I think that is another way of saying what I said a moment ago.
But there are aspects of this suit that was filed against Rose and Zachary that really do predicate their allegations entirely on the 2008 purchase transaction.
I think, there is an allegation as to the failure to obtain a resale disclosure package, which I think there would be an overlap there.
Okay, let's pause just for a second.
Yes.
That's exactly what I'm saying. There is an overlap, I think, there. Why wouldn't res judicata at least apply to that overlap?
We don't believe that it should because there are two separate representations here. Representations in terms of undertaking by an attorney to represent the client. And the failure to get the resale disclosure package is not only a breach of the earlier agreement, it's a breach of the later agreement. And we would submit that the failure to do that in terms of the earlier agreement, it can be a part of the representation in both instances. So
why is the latter simply a consequence of the former? You didn't get the information, you didn't share it with us, and then you filed this dumb lawsuit presupposing that the information wasn't there. And if you'd have told us that, we would never have filed this lawsuit. Isn't that the same thing?
No, because we would submit that when they undertook the representation in the litigation in the Arlington County action, they made a new, or undertook a new obligation to get that resale disclosure package. That was separate from the obligation that they had to do that, in the earlier action. So
Zachary was sued for the litigation malpractice claim, right?
Yes.
And he was sued in the same proceeding. His claim was joined with the claim for the malpractice based upon the 2008 purchase transaction against Rose. Am I right there, too?
Correct. Yes.
So you can't join claims absent a transaction occurrence being common. So isn't that an implicit recognition that they were part of the same transaction or occurrence, else you would not have joined them in the first instance?
I was not the one who filed the first action, the action in Fairfax County in which they were joined.
Okay.
I think the response to that was that they were not properly joined in that first Fairfax County action.
Okay, so the symmetry of your argument then is sound, if it's right, which is Res judicata doesn't apply, and it should have never been joined in the first place, but nobody raised it.
Nobody raised it. That's it. That's exactly right. And then...
Can I ask you a question about this resale disclosure package? In the second lawsuit concerning the litigation, you say that they failed to review the information in the resale disclosure package. Does it exist?
I think for purposes of this case, we have to treat it as existing. It was never contested. They're legally required to have that. So I think it's a safe assumption that it exists somewhere. And that they do have it. It's never been contested that it exists.
Well, don't you think at minimum, given the ruling in the first lawsuit, that certainly you would be collaterally stopped from any claim asserting that their failure to get the resale disclosure package was malpractice?
There's been no allegation of collateral estoppel. As this court has made clear, collateral estoppel is an entirely separate procedural vehicle, or procedural animal from the claim of res judicata. And again, collateral estoppel has never been raised in this case as a defense. This case also presents an instance of judicial estoppel, because in the prior proceeding, we were told that these two representations are separate proceedings. That's why the statute of limitations ran as to the one. We're now basically told that by the appellees that they're the same proceeding. And again, they won a judgment in the prior proceeding. They got this petition for appeal in the earlier proceeding dismissed in this court. They've received the benefit of the argument that these representations are separate matters. They should be bound by that in this case. I'm going to conclude my remarks.
May I ask a question about your fourth assignment of error? As I look at your brief, I don't see any authority cited therein. Is that assignment of error defective under Rule 527?
I don't believe so, because I can't find any authorities on that subject. Basically, what we would have are the authorities which define what res judicata is, and the five counts that do not relate to the resale disclosure package would have nothing to do, absolutely nothing to do, with the with what occurred in 2008 on the transactional work deal.
So why wouldn't the authorities underpinning res judicata be the authorities in support of your fourth assignment, as opposed to citing no authority?
To the extent that we have them, they would be. And our position would be that they would, if they're in the third assignment error, they would carry over into the fourth as well.
You have 2 minutes and 6 seconds remaining.
Thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Matthew Lee, and I have the privilege of representing the athletes in this case, Francis Moroz and Stephen Zachary. Both Mr. Moroz and Mr. Zachary are longstanding members of the bar of this court. The questions presented in this appeal are two. First, whether the 3-year limitation period applicable to Moonlight's legal malpractice claim expired prior to the filing of this lawsuit, that date being February 10, 2015. The second issue is whether Moonlight's claim against Mr. Moroz is barred by the doctrine of res judicata. Respectfully, the trial court correctly concluded that the statute of limitations had expired prior to the filing date of this lawsuit, and that res judicata barred Moonlight's claims against Mr. Moroz individually.
Can I interrupt you with a question? If in the first lawsuit I were a trial judge hearing it, and the case came before me, and there are two claims against Moroz, I know this is a hypothetical, it didn't happen, One is malpractice based upon the purchase agreement deal in 2008 in a real estate context. And the second one is he fouled up a litigation completely related to the first, but he fouled it up in ways unrelated to the 2008 default. Wouldn't I say, well, why did you join these claims? These are two separate claims. One of them's got to be dismissed and filed separately and let take its own track.
That may well be, Your Honor. Unfortunately, that's not our case. There was no argument. First of all, there was no separate cause of action or claim brought against Mr. Moroz for his conduct in the 2010 lawsuit, the Arlington lawsuit.
Right. My question's really loaded, so I don't want to trick you, but what I'm trying to say is that if those two hypothetical claims could have been joined under the joinder statutes in the first suit, that is, he's malpracticed in 2008 to mess up with the purchase agreement, and he also screwed the litigation up, 2010. Could they be joined in the same case?
I believe so, Your Honor, and that bears out with the fact that, in fact, count two of the first lawsuit against Mr. Zachary alleged just that. Essentially, what they alleged against Mr. Zachary in the first lawsuit is what they're alleging against Mr. Moroz now. So I do think, if Your Honor is going towards res judicata issues on this, I do think they could have been joined. And skipping to the res judicata argument, this is a classic example of claim splitting. This court has adopted many years ago the concept of could have, should have. And that concept, respectfully, I believe, remains alive and well in this country. And so, particularly after the enactment or the adoption of Rule 1:6, which I believe was a direct response to the majority opinion in Davis v. Marshall Holmes, which seemed to backtrack on the court's trend of adopting the modern authorities, broadening the definition of cause of action and claims. Now, I think that the dissents in Davis by Justice Kinzer and Chief Justice Lemons correctly noted that the majority opinion in Davis effectively would almost eviscerate the could have, should have argument under res judicata principles. So I think that in this particular case, the cause of action that they assert had accrued when the first lawsuit was brought. The right of action had accrued, and they could have brought it. And that fact is laid bare by the fact that they made the same allegations, the same count against Mr. Zachary. Thus, when the final order or the order of dismissing with prejudice Mr. Moroz from the first lawsuit occurred, the concept of could have, should have enters into the fact. Now, with respect to the statute of limitations argument, the trial court heard evidence during a hearing, and that evidence established, or based upon that evidence, the trial court concluded that the services, my clients had terminated the attorney-client contract or the relationship relative to the trial as of January 19th, 2012. And they did so via a phone call with Mrs. Nadimi, one of the principals of Moonlight, and then followed that up with an email to Mr. Nadimi, her husband, the other principal in Moonlight, expressly terminating the attorney-client contract. Now, what happened following that is the parties had already submitted a final order to Chief Judge Newman for entry. Unfortunately, on January 12th, unfortunately, the court lost that order. And following January 19th, after the cessation of the attorney-client relationship, the court advised the parties that they needed to submit a new order. My client typed up an identical order, identical objections, signed it, and on January 26th sent it over to opposing counsel, who then submitted it to the trial court for entry. Our position is that the attorney-client relationship ended as of January 19th. An unforeseen circumstance occurred where the court lost the order, thus causing my client had to have to prepare and endorse a new order to be submitted to the court. But that does not change the fact. So even if the court believes that that's a legal service, the continuous legal representation rule, that does not change the fact that that was the last legal service ended, and it is buttressed by the fact that prior to that, he had terminated the attorney-client relationship. Now, when I say he, I mean Mr. Zachary. I think Justice Kelsey correctly noted during my opposing counsel's argument that Mr. Moreau's, the evidence in the joint appendix and in the record in this case demonstrates that Mr. Moreau's did not provide any legal services following the August 18th, 2011 trial. So applying the continuous legal representation rule as it is stated in Keller v. Denny, certainly Mr. Moreau's, the statute of limitations on him under the toll was lifted well prior to 2012. Implicit in this is that the cause of action and right of actions for the legal malpractice claims that they asserted had already accrued prior to the entry date of the order, the final judgment order. In other words, under 8.01.230, we know that a breach starts or marks the accrual of the right of action. Generally, that means that the statute of limitations begins to run, unless it's told. And in this case, the argument being that the continuous legal representation will toll the running of the statute of limitations until a certain date later after the accrual. Here, I do not believe that the appellants have met their burden in establishing that the trial judge was plainly wrong or lacked any factual support in concluding that the toll was lifted as of January 19th or at its latest date, January 26th.
Rose maintained his status as attorney of record for purposes of pleadings and representation before the court, right?
Correct, Justice Kelsey.
Well, wouldn't it be anomalous for us to have a principle that says the relationship between the circuit court judge and the attorney presupposes an attorney-client relationship, but the statute of limitations does not? Because trial judges, quite understandably, look to the lawyers on the pleadings who maintain and have made a presence in the case as being continuing officers of the court on behalf of their clients.
Certainly there may be an ethical duty under, as suggested by Moonlight under Rule 1.16, that requires an attorney in a litigation setting to seek an order, entry of an order, in order to withdraw. But this court has never, in passing upon the continuous legal representation rule, never tied a formal order withdrawing in litigation to the terminus of the lifting of the toll.
But have we done the opposite either, which is to say that the accrual occurs prior to the attorney's release from the case vis-a-vis the
circuit? I think, Your Honor, respectfully, if you look at the Shipman v. Krupp, in Shipman, the focus of that decision was not necessarily on when the continuous legal representation ended. However, in Shipman, it was noted that the attorney withdrew. There was no mention that the withdrawal was a formal withdrawal based upon the order, an order of the court.
What other kind of withdrawal can you have before court?
Well, I think it may have been a word of semantics, but withdrawal meaning he advised, as stated in Shipman, the attorney advised his clients that there had been this mistake and that it would be better if he withdrew from their representation in order, because he was probably going to have to be a witness in later proceedings. Now, I can tell you, it was not stated in the decision in Shipman, but I went back and I looked at the bankruptcy PACER account before coming here today. It's a matter of public record. The order withdrawing Mr. Krupp's appearance was not the same date that this court concluded that he had withdrew from the representation of his clients. I believe the date was January 19th in Shipman. If the court's docket, the bankruptcy court's docket, reveals that an order was not entered to that effect until 2 weeks later. So, I do not believe that this court has ever tied the continuous legal representation rule to the ethical responsibility of an attorney to seek an order under Rule 1.16. And I'll give you an example, Your Honor, that I brought here today. Assume that a young associate in a large law firm enters his appearance along with 10 other attorneys on a given case. As happens quite a bit these days, that young attorney decides to go to greener pastures and leaves the firm. The firm, however, continues on representing the client. For whatever reason, the young attorney or the firm never files a motion to withdraw his appearance or her appearance. So there's no order entered. 5 to 10 years later, the litigation or the transaction for which the attorney, including the associate, were retained, has ended. To say that that young attorney who had left the firm 5 years or a decade earlier, the statute of limitations was told as to that young attorney for the entire time, I don't think it would be a reasonable application of the rule.
But what if the young attorney filed the action and signed the pleading and then failed to get a withdrawal and then went to greener pastures and then some later lawyer in the case messed the case up? Why is it so unfair to say, look, you didn't get a withdrawal, the court still thought you were counsel of record, and the law presupposes you were, whether you were walking away from it or not?
Well, I don't... This court, in enacting Kelly, did not tie the lifting of the toll. So let me back up. The continuous legal representation rule, when enacted, specifically said when the attorney's services for a particular undertaking cease or are terminated. Since 1987 in Keller, this court has never held that when services cease or terminate is concurrent or synonymous with the withdrawal date or the entry of an order of withdrawal by a court.
You said that before, and I think Justice Kelsey's retort was, well, we've never held the opposite either, have we? And I think your answer was no, but you've looked at a file which indicates that maybe we did, but maybe we did so unconsciously.
Well, perhaps.
So I think that's where we are on that.
And it certainly would be difficult to segment the malpractice litigation where you've got to hop on one particular attorney, perhaps while the case is even pending, right, and say, well, you got out at this date, so I've got to watch my statute of limitations, so I'm going to drop this malpractice lawsuit on you so I don't get kicked out on statute of limitations grounds. But then these other lawyers, why they can continue representing me and then I'll sue them later. I mean, it gets pretty tricky just trying to think how that would work in the real world.
It may, Your Honor, but in this particular case, in our case, what we have here is a distinct retainer, the prosecution of a declaratory judgment action. They had hired, Moonlight had hired new counsel, separate counsel, to handle the appeal. The trial was done. The judge's rulings in that case were done. The final order was done. My client signed that order and submitted it to the court on January 26th, approximately 15 days before the entry date of the order. So, again, what we're talking about here is whether or not when the last service is rendered for the particular undertaking were provided. Thank you, Your Honor.
Rebuttal?
I was asked a question earlier about the appellee's position that if the statute of limitations has to run as to both attorneys. That is on page record 70, where they say, quote, until the date that either defendant last performed legal services for Moonlight in the Berkeley lawsuit. Again, that was their position in the court below. They brought up the principle of could have, should have, and I would submit that is answered by footnote 4 on page 16, 670 of Bates versus Devers. 214 Virginia, where this court said you don't have to bring every, the could have, should have rule doesn't mean you have to bring everything that you have against a party at the time you file the lawsuit. just what is related to the particular cause of action that you've pled. There was a reference to the submission of the order. What matters is the entry of the order as per the Van Dam case versus Gay, and that was page 463-280 Virginia, in which the court held that the claim did not accrue until the entry of the order. The standard of review here is de novo, as per the Hensel Phelps construction case 791 Southeastern 2nd, 734, decided on November 3rd of this year after the briefing of the case was completed. We have undisputed facts in this case, and again, accordingly, the standard of review is de novo. And I think it was significant that Mr. Lee used the term distinct retainers, and that's exactly what we have in the representation of the defendants and the representation by the defendants of my clients. We have distinct retainers. They're not the same causes of action. Therefore, race judicata does not apply. Thank you.
Thank you very much.